My name is Doug Cox, and on behalf of the D.C. Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society, welcome to our July luncheon. We are honored and delighted to have as our guest today Ted Olson, the former Solicitor General of the United States and the Society's good friend and advisor. Ted will be sharing with us his annual roundup of the recent Supreme Court term. It's always notable that we can pull such a crowd on a summer Friday. Just to make it additionally challenging, we keep raising the prices, but you keep coming. There's evidently a considerable degree of price inelasticity in hearing Ted Olson talk about the Supreme Court. Of course, one significant development at the court this year was Justice Souter's resignation. We can salute Justice Souter for his service, however much we might question his timing. There's not been much discussion about Justice Souter's contribution to the court's jurisprudence. Although he came to be classified as a predictable vote on the so-called liberal wing of the court, he's not widely viewed as having put a personal imprint on the law or on how cases are argued or analyzed. As the New York Times phrased it, the consensus among admirers and detractors alike is that his influence is likely to be limited. But that analysis overlooks what I believe is Justice Souter's unique contribution to the development of the court. His contribution may not be to the court's jurisprudence, but rather to the doctrines of the executive branch as it develops its own body of tradition and guiding canons to handle vacancies on the court. That new doctrine can be summed up as no more Souters. In its less pungent form, no more stealth nominees. You can see that doctrine at work in the nominations of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito. You can see it at work in a lot of the criticism of the nomination of Harriet Myers. And certainly the Obama administration has applied the same doctrine. Whatever one thinks of Judge Sotomayor, she's no stealth candidate. There's no need for the Obama White House to assure its supporters that she will be a home run. As Justice Scalia said in another context, this wolf comes as a wolf, or at least as a wise Latino woman. Whatever happens with the nomination process now or in the future, our guest today is an expert in the difficult job of keeping up with the evolving thinking of the justices. Ted demonstrates that expertise in case after case. Although Ted likes to give us some statistics at these lunches, here are a few numbers he might not get around to. Ted concluded his tenure as Solicitor General with an astonishing win rate of 82%. Since his return to private practice, Ted's win rate has remained at equally astonishing 77%. On the very first day of the term, the very first argument, Ted gave his 50th argument before the court. He argued a total of 6 cases this term, 1-3 with one set for re-argument. Indeed, that case will be re-argued in September, still part of the 2008 term, giving Ted 7 arguments this term, just to make sure that any advocate who might happen to have a mere 6 arguments knows who's boss. The case to be re-argued is Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, a constitutional challenge to the campaign finance regulation. Now, in setting the case for re-argument, the court asked whether part of its 2003 decision in McConnell versus FEC, upholding the constitutionality of McCain-Feingold, should be overruled. And of course, McCain-Feingold was upheld in McConnell based on arguments by then Solicitor General Ted Olson, representing his then client. In effect, the court has set up an experiment. Ted argues in favor of McCain-Feingold. It's upheld. Now he argues against McCain-Feingold. Will it be struck down? Does the constitutionality of campaign finance depend solely on which side Ted Olson advocates? This year, as in years past, the justice most likely to oppose Ted's position purely as a matter of voting patterns was Justice Ginsburg, joined this year by Justice Stevens. Notably, Justice Souter voted in favor of Ted's position the same number of times as the Chief Justice, Justice Thomas, Justice Alito, and Justice Scalia, just not in the same cases. Indeed, in one case, the Chief and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito all voted for Ted's position, yet Ted lost the case. In another case, the Chief and Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito all voted against Ted's position, yet Ted won the case. So maybe all those news articles about the monolithic Roberts Court and its supposed turn to the right are a touch exaggerated. Ted received his law degree in 1965 from the University of California at Berkeley and joined the Gibson Dunn law firm in its Los Angeles office. In 1981, he was appointed by President Reagan to serve as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Upon returning to the private sector, he joined Gibson Dunn's Washington office, where he led the firm's appellate practice. In 2000, he argued both of the election cases before the Supreme Court. Thereafter, he was confirmed as Solicitor General and served in that position from 2001 to 2004. At the time of Ted's resignation, Nedan Totenberg stated, quote, "By everyone's reckoning, he's done an outstanding job." Ted once again returned to Gibson Dunn, where he continues his appellate and constitutional law practice and also leads the firm's crisis management practice. He is a fellow of both the American College of Trial Lawyers and the American Academy of Appellate Lawyers. And as the American Lawyer observed, if there were a Hall of Fame for Supreme Court advocates, Ted Olson would certainly make it on the first cut. One of Ted's clients this year was a little more direct. As his case was racing toward the Supreme Court and ultimate victory, the client explained why he had picked Ted to handle the argument. "We can't afford to lose this case, and Ted Olson is without doubt the best appellate advocate in the United States." And as we all know, in this business, the client is always right. Ted.
Welcome, Federalists. Thank you, Doug, for that very entertaining introduction. Apparently, I failed once again to admonish you not to set the bar too high for the act that you are introducing. The model you were looking for is the late Ed McMahon. Bland and obsequious. Perhaps in your defense, you found it impossible not to be a hard act to follow. If that's the problem, next year, I'll tell the jokes, and you give the speech about ERISA, Chevron deference, and the tonnage clause. I'm fully aware that the principal reason for so many of you being here at the Supreme Court annual roundup is to celebrate our annual recognition of outstanding recent acts of political buffoonery and public figure self-abasement. We could call these, to use a phrase invented and practiced by the Clintons, the politics of personal destruction, miraculously described as the act of personally destroying oneself politically. The highlight reel, for some of you who have been following this, would include Sharon Stone's tricking her unwitting husband into a shoeless visit into the Komodo dragon cage at the Los Angeles Zoo, with the predictable consequences. Another one was client number 9's expensive present to himself and to the American people at the Mayflower Hotel down the street. I don't think that's why we abandoned the Mayflower Hotel. And, of course, Madonna's appropriately named Sweet and Sticky Tour. I hate to disappoint you, but there's nothing this year to measure up to those kind of lofty standards. There have, of course, been the usual daily revelations of idiotic political moves and senseless act of public self-degradation, but they all have seemed so recently and so this year so predictable and banal. Besotted governors, senators, and presidential candidates bedding down with and then attempting to buy off youthful staff and campaign functionaries is so commonplace that you just don't want to hear about it anymore. And, of course, it never works, especially since they all seem to want to chronicle their madness with emails. We did enjoy Governor Sanford's addition of Buenos Aires to the plot line. And his description is in today's paper, describing extramarital sex as self-guided sightseeing. Where do they come up with these things? But his endless, meandering, weeping mea culpas made it all seem like another third-rate romance, low-rent rendezvous. We always quote country and western songs. And I won't even bother with Marion Barry's stalking arrest. I just don't believe he did it. Anyone who fails to file his tax returns, well, on probation for failing to file his tax return, is just not going to make it as a stalker. We also ruled out Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi, who apparently tuned up for this week's G8 summit in Italy by trysting with 18-year-old prostitutes. But it turns out, as he explained it, he was just describing and enjoying the pleasure of conquest. No big deal. I mean, he is Italian, right? And we have to thank the New York Times for clarifying for us why this keeps happening. I don't know whether you saw it. There was an article in Science Times this Tuesday explaining, as they put it, how the imp in your brain keeps getting out. It was a great article. I'd encourage you to see it. In an essay, they report, called The Imp of the Perverse, Edgar Allan Poe explained that the impulse to do naughty things increases to a wish, the wish to a desire, and the desire to an uncontrollable longing. The article reveals that the more you think about how wrong, stupid, and unacceptable it would be to behave in a childish, selfish, self-destructive fashion, the more the itch to do it becomes irresistible. This explains why the most pious and self-righteous politicians crash and burn so spectacularly. They proclaim so much about not doing it that they have no choice but to do it. Now, there's a moral to this story. Beware of those that preach moderation, celibacy, and prudence. Their imp is about to escape from their brains and unleash their libidos onto the front page of the newspapers. Well, we are supposed to get CLE credit for this. I've instructed the Federalist Society. So if we're going to even do it retroactively, nunc pro tunc, as they say, we must now discuss the Supreme Court's October 2008 term. This term may be remembered less for a series of headline-making cases than for slight incremental changes and the things the court did not do. And, of course, for the retirement, as Doug mentioned, after 19 years of Justice David Souter, the gentle, distinguished New Englander who broke so many conservative hearts from the moment he was appointed by a Republican president to the day this spring when he presented a newly elected Democratic president the opportunity to name his successor. Justice Souter was appointed in 1990 by President George Herbert Walker Bush to replace Justice William J. Brennan. You may recall that President Eisenhower identified the appointment of the liberal Justice Brennan as one of his greatest mistakes as president. Justice Souter lived up to his predecessor's legacy. President Bush slipped on the same banana peel that was left there by President Eisenhower. Because Justice Souter lived up to his predecessor's legacy by becoming a reliable liberal on the court, seemingly within minutes of his appointment. To give you some measure of this, there were 23 5-4 decisions last term. Justice Souter and Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg voted together in 22 of the 23. Justice Thomas, on the other hand, was on the same side as Justice Ginsburg in just 4 of these 23 cases. Justice Thomas and Justice Souter voted together in just 5 of the 23. So you can see that Justice Souter was regularly lining up with Justice Ginsburg, and I just used Justice Thomas as the antithesis of that point of view. On the final day for the court in June, the Chief Justice read a letter to Justice Souter from his colleagues, noting Justice Souter's desire to trade, quote, white marble for white mountains, to return to your land of, quote again, or quoting Robert Frost this time, of easy wind and Downy Flake. Justice Souter responded with his own Frost poem, referring to, quote, the ideal of the life engaged, where love and need are one. Given Justice Souter's jurisprudence, perhaps he should have quoted another Frost statement. Quote, I never dared to be radical when young for fear it would make me conservative when old. He certainly avoided that trap. Frost also said revealingly of New Hampshire, she's one of the best states in the Union. Vermont's the other. So Republican presidents, Doug, may in the future be well advised to avoid nominating justices who quote New England poets. That should be a tip-off. President Obama, as Doug mentioned, is nominated, as we all know, Second Circuit Justice Sonia Sotomayor to replace Justice Souter and become the 111th justice. If confirmed, she will be the third new justice in 4 years after nearly a 12-year interval without a change on the court. She will be the third woman appointed to the court and the court's first Hispanic. The new court will consist of 9 former federal appeals court judges. Justice Souter had been a federal appeals court judge as well, but as the Chief Justice noted at the Fourth Circuit Conference just a few days ago, he had only served on the First Circuit for about 5 minutes. Justice Sotomayor has been on the Second Circuit for nearly 11 years, before that having been a federal district judge appointed by George Herbert Walker Bush. So here we go again. An all-federal appellate judge Supreme Court is a relatively new phenomenon. Just 50 years ago, in 1953, the Warren Court that decided Brown versus Board of Education had only one former federal appeals court judge. That court consisted of 1 former governor, 3 former senators, 2 former United States attorneys general, 2 former solicitors general, 1 SEC chair, and 1 academic. One might debate which demographic is preferable, but a Supreme Court, I think as Doug mentioned, consisting primarily of federal appellate jurists is the way it's likely to be for the foreseeable future, because presidents, having learned from past mostly Republican presidential mistakes, are likely to want to see some sort of federal appellate track record for the individuals they send to the Supreme Court. Ivy League schools will continue to be amply represented on the court, assuming the confirmation of Judge Sotomayor, 5 from Harvard and 3 from Yale. Now, that may seem good to some of you out there, but it is an interesting commentary. 8 of the 9 justices from 2 law schools. And the court's clerks come from the same place, essentially. 16 of the 32 clerks hired for next term, Justice Souter had not hired any, they get 4 each, 16 of the 32 went to law school at Harvard or Yale. Every single one of them came to the court from federal appeals court clerkships, every single one. 30 of the 32 came from just 5 circuits, the 2nd, 4th, 6th, 9th, and the D.C. circuit. 21, or 2/3 of the 32, came from clerkships with just 8 separate federal judges. 21 of the 32. This is, I'm gathering, the Supreme Court's definition of diversity. Now, if the law firms could do that, that would be okay. Justice Scalia has railed against the court's imposition on the nation of the ideals, as he put it, favored by the elite class from which the members of this institution are selected, and, as he put it, the law profession culture. Given the statistics you've just heard, you can see exactly what he is talking about. Easy confirmation is predicted for Judge Sotomayor, and there's little reason to think that the persons making those predictions are wrong. Democrats have now 59 senators and 1 comedian voting with them. That's enough to prevent a filibuster. Moreover, Republicans and Democrats have approached the Supreme Court confirmation process differently. Since the Bork nomination in 1987, Republican senators cast only 3 and 9 votes, respectively, against Clinton nominees Ginsburg and Breyer. 3 and 9 votes. On the other hand, Democratic senators cast 58, 48, 22, and 43 negative votes against Republican President Supreme Court nominees Bork, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito. Justice Kennedy was in there and skated through rather easily, but of course he was the anti-Bork at that point. And Justice Souter received only 9 no votes, but I think that the Democrats knew that he was going to turn out to be Justice Souter. Thus, we see that Republican senators seem to be willing to vote to confirm qualified Supreme Court nominees of the opposing party. Democratic senators and their affiliated interest groups will go to the battle station every single time. As for Hispanics, Democratic senators wouldn't even allow a vote on Miguel Estrada's nomination to the D.C. Circuit. Republicans will turn the other cheek. There were 75 opinions from the court this term. That's a 12% increase over the average of 67 during the last 3 terms. If you have the number low enough, the percentage, you can get the percentage up without adding too many. But it's a far cry from the 150 cases per term the court was deciding when William H. Rehnquist became Chief Justice 20 years ago. Each justice wrote a minimum. There were a couple more for some of them, but a minimum of 7 opinions for the court, grinding out, on an average, 1 opinion for each argument month. According to my unaudited calculations, Justice Kennedy produced 7 opinions for the court, 3 concurring opinions, and 2 dissenting opinions for a total of 12 opinions this term. That comes out to 1.3 opinions per month for the 9 months from October through June, 3 opinions for each of his 4 law clerks. I think that's maybe why they live so long. Of course, Justice Kennedy's opinions for the court came in closely divided cases. 2 were 6-3, 5 were 5-4, so opinion writing to hold such fragile majorities may have been somewhat labor-intensive. Justices Stevens and Breyer each churned out 28 majority, concurring, and dissenting opinions, including each 15 dissenting opinions. Justice Stevens turned 89 on April 20 and lives in Florida most of the year. He has turned out 28 opinions. He is involved in every case, asks devilishly penetrating questions, and is a consummate tactician. He is within shouting distance of being both the longest-serving justice on the court and the oldest to serve on the court. And he will surely be remembered as one of the most influential. Anyone who has appeared before him knows what an intellect he is and a tactician. Justice Kennedy, again, was the swing vote in most of the court's mostly closely divided cases. Justice Kennedy was in the majority of 19 of those 23 5-4 opinions and wrote the opinion for the court in 5 of them. He voted with conservatives this year in 75% of the 5-4 decisions where there was a typical conservative-liberal split. There were a few cases where the justices, for various reasons, broke not along typical ideological lines. The liberals had a relatively hard time of it this year in close cases. They handed victories to trial lawyers and state attorneys general in the 3 preemption cases, I'll return to that, and seemingly forced the court to issue narrow, compromise, incremental opinions in several cases, but it was mostly a disappointing year for the liberal wing of the court. And I keep using those terms because everybody else that comments about the court uses the term liberal and conservative. I would resist it, but I can't think of what I would call it, and then there'd be all kinds of questions about what in the world I was talking about. So you know what I mean. As a measure of the liberal-conservative balance this term, conservatives authored opinions for the court in 17 of the 25 5-4 decisions. The conservative bloc, including Justice Kennedy, wrote a total of only 24 dissents, whereas the liberals wrote 49, twice as many. So that gives you an idea of how the court was splitting this year. The court reversed a lower court in 75% of the cases it considered this year. The Ninth Circuit, I know you've been waiting for this. If I left out the Ninth Circuit, you know, I mean, we would have cut the attendance in half. The Ninth Circuit, you will be thrilled to hear, was actually affirmed in 1.5 cases of its 14 that got to the Supreme Court. That's a good year. And it's considerably less dreadful than it sounds when one considers the rate at which the Supreme Court pushes the reject button in most of the cases it handles. The 08 term would have been more memorable had the court reached a result in three cases it did not decide. It dismissed as improvidently granted a petition seeking review of a $79.5 million punitive damage award against Philip Morris. The court had previously overturned this award because the amount of the award seemed to be based on harm to non-parties as opposed to the plaintiff in the case, other smokers. On remand, however, the Oregon Supreme Court found a new procedural hook on which to base its previous and then again affirmance of the award. That had all the flavor of a state Supreme Court thumbing its nose at the Supreme Court, which is presumably why the court took the case again this term. But after hearing argument, the court dismissed the petition as improvidently granted, preventing us from knowing more about how the newest justices, Roberts and Alito, will rule on future constitutional limits to punitive damages. This is a very important question because Justices Stevens, Scalia, Thomas, and Ginsburg, there's one of those unusual divisions or blocks, harbor serious reservations about constitutional limits on punitive damages. And Justice Souter, one of those who had supported restraints on punitive damages, has now left the court. So this is going to be a very important issue to see where Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito will be. We will have to, and Justice Sotomayor, if she's confirmed. We're going to have to wait for the next case to see where this issue has been. It's been in a state of evolution for about 20 years. And we're going to have to see where it's going to go. That's the first one the court really didn't get to. The second one was the court dismissed as moot at the Solicitor General's request the Almari case, which would have tested the government's power to seize and indefinitely detain a person lawfully living in the United States who has been charged with being a terrorist. The issue is likely to return to the court, although the Obama administration is going to try Almari in civilian courts. It is suggested that it may yet detain terrorists if they cannot be tried in criminal proceedings or otherwise unloaded on nations more willing to accept them than 50 out of the United States, 50 states. As I will discuss later, that's the second one the court didn't decide. And as I will discuss later, the court also did not decide, but Doug mentioned, but set for re-argument a major challenge to an aspect of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance laws. I'm going to save that one for later, David. We're going to get to it. The court considered three cases involving the delicate subject of race last term. Two involved the Voting Rights Act of 1965. In the first, Bartlett versus Strickland, the court waded once again into the impenetrable thicket created by the 1982 amendments to the Voting Rights Act, which added Section 2B, prohibiting any redistricting that would have, I'm sounding like President Bush. It's a good thing the word statistics wasn't in here. Redistricting that would have the effect of according less opportunity to minorities than other members of the electorate to elect representatives of their choice. Less opportunity to minorities to elect other members than other members of the electorate to elect representatives of their choice. How does one measure something that intangible? And what is the remedy if you do find a violation? These questions have spawned a body of head-spinning jurisprudence describing and evaluating such judicial inventions as majority-minority districts, minority-influence districts, minority-opportunity districts, crossover districts, and coalitional districts. Each concept involves a peculiar formulas for identifying and remedying actionable vote dilution, including the evaluation of such things as compactness and political cohesiveness of minority voters in particular districts or particular regions of a state. And each seems to presume that people vote at least partially as blocks according to race, an invidious premise, it seems to me, and one that has had perverse unintended consequences. The terminology and jurisprudence that has developed in this area is so Orwellian that it prompted Chief Justice Roberts to say in his first voting rights opinion 3 years ago, "It is a sordid business, this divvying us up by race." in Bartlett, the best that the court could do was a three-justice plurality written by Justice Kennedy, which I could not begin to explain, and a two-justice concurrence by Justices Thomas and Scalia, rejecting altogether the framework of the court's principal precedent in this area as having, quote, produced a disastrous misadventure of judicial policymaking, close quote. There were three separate dissenting opinions. So you had five opinions, a three-justice plurality, two justices rejecting all of the precedents, and then three separate dissenting opinions, none of which agreed with one another. The law in this area, voting rights, is not only utterly incomprehensible, but it seems to me pernicious because it is constantly reconfiguring voting districts to achieve desired race-based outcomes, thus encouraging racial balkanization, the last thing in the world this country needs. In the final argument of the term, the last one argued, Northwest Austin versus Holder, the court considered Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. That provision, this is another one, that provision requires 9 states and portions of 7 other states to submit changes in voting procedures to the Justice Department for preclearance. The covered jurisdictions were defined decades ago based upon perceived historical patterns of discrimination, but which are hopelessly out of date now. As Justice Kennedy inquired during the oral argument, are the governments in one area to be trusted less than the governments in another area? Is the sovereignty of Georgia less than the sovereign dignity of Michigan? This case is a perfect illustration of the irrationality and inconsistency of the expensive preclearance requirements. The Texas Utility District involved in this case had been created in 1987, long after the enactment of the Voting Rights Act, and that district had demonstrated that there had never been any evidence of discrimination in voting in the district. That's from the court. While the question and oral argument suggested that the justices were prepared to toss out Section 5 altogether, 8 of the justices opted at the end of the day for what read very much like a last-minute compromise, awkwardly construing Section 5 as allowing covered districts to bail out of the preclearance process. This, of course, will only serve to postpone the inevitable constitutional evaluation of a process that no longer makes any sense, but which members of Congress will repeatedly vote overwhelmingly to extend as long as they are voting for something called voting rights. I think it was a compromise in part because it was argued sort of in late April. Sometimes the court has trouble with hard cases that are argued in April because that's the least amount of time to get these opinions out by June. And you had a sense, if you were there during the announcement of this decision, the way the Chief Justice who announced the result sounded like he was going to go ahead and say, we're not shirking from our duty to declare things unconstitutional, and then he shirked from his duty to declare things unconstitutional. So something happened. The third civil rights case was Rieke versus New Haven, a case involving a city that had tossed out the results of firefighter promotion tests because white candidates did overwhelmingly better than minority candidates. The white and Hispanic firefighters who had passed the exams were thus denied promotions and sued for employment discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. New Haven responded that it had to start the process over with new tests because it otherwise would have been sued under Title VII by the passed over firefighters because of the disparate racial impact of the tests. Besides, it argued, no one was promoted and therefore no one had been the victim of discrimination. You see what kind of arguments these cases require people to make. The Supreme Court, as you know, reversed. In a somewhat strained 5-4 opinion by Justice Kennedy, the court concluded that New Haven could not throw out those test results and thus intentionally discriminate against the white firefighters who had passed the test unless it had a strong basis in evidence to believe that failure to do so would subject it to disparate impact liability. Finding that New Haven could not have been held liable for the results of its job-related tests, the court found no legitimate basis for discarding the tests simply because of an unwarranted fear of litigation. Justice Scalia's concurrence made the point that the court's resolution merely postpones the evil day when the court will have to confront the question whether and to what extent the disparate impact provisions of Title VII are inconsistent with the prohibition of disparate treatment under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. In other words, when may an employer intentionally discriminate against one race to make up for test results or other procedures that produce a disparate impact on another racial group? As he said, that evil day is going to come when the court is going to have to resolve that question. The court's Rieke decision, as you've all read, overturned a one-paragraph Second Circuit panel summary affirmance of a district court summary judgment. A petition for rehearing en banc was denied on a vote of 7-6. The panel decision, the one-paragraph panel decision, included Judge Sonia Sotomayor, President Obama's nominee to replace Justice Souter. President Obama has said that the capacity for empathy was an important consideration in selecting her. It was therefore notable that in her dissent that she summarized in open court the day of the decision, Justice Ginsburg used that same word, saying that the higher scoring firefighters understandably attract the court's empathy. When the printed version of the decision was released, however, the word sympathy was placed in the word empathy. Maybe it was there when she read it, but she used the word empathy. Justice Alito responded in his dissent that the firefighters passed over by New Haven were not interested in sympathy, but merely asked to be accorded the right, quote, even-handed enforcement of the prohibition against discrimination based on race. The only First Amendment religion case this term, there's usually one or two or three, involved the religious organization Summum, founded in 1975 and headquartered in Salt Lake City. There is another religion in Salt Lake City. The Summum religion wanted the city of Pleasant Grove, Utah, to place a permanent monument containing the seven aphorisms of Summum in a public park that already contained a wishing well, a September 11 monument, a Ten Commandments monument, and a whole bunch of other edifices. The court held that the park and its existing monuments amounted to government speech, and that the government of this city, Pleasant Grove, was entitled to say what it wishes on its own property as long as it did not violate certain constitutional restraints like the Establishment Clause. Declining a monument to seven aphorisms did not violate the Establishment Clause. I think probably if you haven't read the opinion, if you haven't studied the Summum religion, the seven aphorisms, here's what the history that you need. The seven aphorisms were inscribed on the original tablets handed down by God to Moses on Mount Sinai. Moses looked them over, decided that the Israelites were not ready for the aphorisms, destroyed them, went back to God, and came back with Ten Commandments. Seems to me that the city fathers of Mount Pleasant showed very good judgment here. Until our people have demonstrated that we're ready for the Ten Commandments, we're surely not ready for the seven aphorisms. Incidentally, I haven't seen them and I didn't see them in the opinion, but I'm told that one of the seven aphorisms is one that we can use in our everyday lives. It goes, "Don't try to teach a pig to sing. It won't work and it annoys the pig." I think when we find the seven, we'll see that's in there. For the first time in its history, the court took up the issue of the effect of campaign contribution arms race in judicial elections on the impartiality of judges. Caperton versus Massey involved a West Virginia dispute between two coal companies. A jury returned a $50 million verdict against Massey for maliciously driving Caperton out of business. Massey's chief executive wasn't finished just by losing this case in the trial court. He promptly announced his intention to appeal the verdict to the West Virginia Supreme Court and to elect a justice that was more favorable to him than one of the incumbent justices. He contributed $3 million to elect Justice Benjamin to replace Justice McGraw. $3 million was more than the total amount spent by all other Benjamin supporters and three times the amount spent by Benjamin's own committee. Spending all this money, you'll be surprised to learn, worked. Benjamin won and McGraw lost. When the case finally did go to the Supreme Court, Caperton moved to disqualify Justice Benjamin as bound to be predisposed to favor Massey, who had just poured $3 million into his campaign, which, by the way, is more money in West Virginia than it might be in New York or California, for example. Benjamin said he wasn't biased and rejected the motion to recuse. He and the two other justices then ruled 3-2 to reverse the $50 million verdict against Massey. Then a rehearing was sought after photographs appeared in newspapers showing one of the other pro-Massey judges vacationing with Blankenship on the French Riviera while the case was pending. And you haven't asked, but yes, there were females in the photographs. The Riviera justice then responded to the predictable public outcry and recused himself. And he was replaced by a justice appointed by Justice Benjamin. Justice Benjamin again declined to withdraw from the case. He was still not biased. And the court again voted 3-2 with the help of Benjamin and the Benjamin appointee to overturn the verdict against Blankenship's company. This was all pretty good going so far for Mr. Blankenship. He was on a winning streak. But Caperton wasn't done either. They sought the help of the United States Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court obviously had trouble deciding whether to take this case or not. The case was listed and relisted five times on the Supreme Court's conference. The Supreme Court finally granted Caperton's cert petition, and by a vote 5-4 vote, with Justice Kennedy writing the court's opinion, set aside the West Virginia Supreme Court decision and ordered Justice Benjamin to recuse himself when the case returns to the West Virginia Supreme Court. And I just learned this morning that it's going to be reheard in the West Virginia Supreme Court on September 8. The court held that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment guarantees a fair trial in a fair tribunal, noting the difficulty in establishing or even inquiring at the actual bias of a judge. The court adopted what it called an objective standard that does not require proof of actual bias in a case. Instead, if there is a, quote, serious risk of, quote, probable bias based upon objective and reasonable perceptions, the Constitution requires disqualification. In this case, because the facts offered the judge a possible temptation not to hold the balance nice, clear, and true, recusal, the court held, was constitutionally required. The dissent by the Chief Justice and the conservative justices on the court uniformly dissented. This is one where Justice Kennedy went with the more liberal justices on the court. The Chief Justice's opinion lamented the slippery slope presented by the ruling, expressing concern about constitutionalizing an issue that has traditionally been handled by statute, and he actually listed 40 separate questions, 1, 2, 3, up through 40, that said were left unopened by the court. Well, what if it's not $3 million? What if it's this? What if it's money spent on the guy that lost? What if it's spent opposing somebody? What if it's an appointment? What if it's a presidential appointment to the Supreme Court of the United States? Good questions. But the majority rejected the dissent's prediction that the sky is going to fall, and we'll just have to see. This case might at least have the salutary benefit of de-incentivizing extravagant campaign contributions in judicial elections by people who expect to come before the judges that they are wanting to support in the election. It's not going to help to give them a lot of money to get elected if they get elected and your case comes before them and then they have to recuse themselves. You might as well save the money. At least half the court's work this term involved the typical diet of cases pertaining to habeas corpus, the death penalty, criminal procedure. These are all important issues, of course, but there's so many of them. Immigration, searches, confessions, the right to counsel, sentencing, and the right of an accused to confront witnesses against him. We're not going to have time today, you'll be relieved to know, to discuss all these cases. And I will also add that I plan to spare you any discussion of the Federal Arbitration Act, bankruptcy, ERISA, and the rights of veterans. These are the cases that the late Chief Justice Rehnquist was fond of referring to as flowers. He's quoting a poem here. Everybody's doing that these days. Flowers born to blush unseen and waste their sweetness on the desert air. We are going to leave them blushing unseen in the desert yet again today. You will thank me for that. I should, however, mention in passing 3 5-4 criminal decisions that may have wider impact. In Herring versus U.S., the court held that the exclusionary rule did not apply to evidence obtained as a result of an unlawful but negligent arrest. The defendant in this case was arrested and searched due to a no longer valid outstanding warrant that police personnel had negligently failed to pull from the database. Applying the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, first announced in 1984 in U.S. versus Leon, the court explained that the excluding the evidence discovered during the search, in this case a gun, and I think drugs, the fruit of the negligent and improper arrest, would allow guilty to go free, but would not deter deliberate, reckless, grossly negligent, or systemic negligence in the process, in the police process, the purpose for the exclusionary rule in the first place. Justice Ginsburg's dissent, this was an opinion by the Chief Justice, objected to the resurrection of a view of the exclusionary rule famously held by the renowned jurists Henry J. Friendly and Benjamin Cardozo. She urged a more majestic conception of the exclusionary rule. Well, she's touched a nerve here because, in fact, the Chief Justice's opinion did rely on the views of Judge Friendly, for whom, by coincidence, he had clerked 30 years before. He dryly commented that, majestic or not, Justice Ginsburg's dissent relied almost exclusively on previous dissents from the court and therefore was not entitled to a lot of deference. In District Attorney's Office versus Osborne, Chief Justice Roberts, again writing for a 5-4 justice majority, held that an individual does not have a due process right to post-conviction DNA testing. This is a tough case, especially in those areas where DNA could conceivably prove actual innocence. Justice Stevens argued in dissent that where the government holds forensic evidence, the testing of which could prove innocence beyond any doubt, the very principle of elemental fairness that dictates pretrial production of exculpatory evidence dictates post-trial production of that same exculpatory evidence. In Melendez-Diaz versus Massachusetts, the court held that the Sixth Amendment's Confrontation Clause requires that laboratory analyses offered by the prosecution in a criminal case this often happens in particularly in drug cases, must be presented by a live witness subject to the defendant's right to cross-examination rather than a certificate or an affidavit by someone in the police department laboratory. This is just the most recent Confrontation Clause case driven by Justice Scalia's strong conviction that the Sixth Amendment means what it says in providing that in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to be confronted with the witnesses against him. He has in this line of cases, the support of an interesting coalition, Justice Stevens, Justice Souter, Justice Thomas, and Justice Ginsburg. Justice Kennedy strongly disagreed with this outcome. You could see that he was angry when the decision was being announced. He disagreed with the expansion of the court's confrontation clause to this scientific evidence and lab reports. His 35-page dissent is interesting reading, and it includes an exegesis into the infamous treason trial of Sir Walter Raleigh. He underscored his disagreement with what he regarded as the majority's body of formalistic and wooden rules divorced from precedent and common sense. I'm going to turn to the environment briefly. The commentariat have uniformly pronounced this term as a disaster for the environment. They base that evaluation on 5 high-profile cases which, according to one professor, taken as a whole, convey a message of extreme hostility to the goals and methods of environmental law. Justice Ginsburg dissented in all 5 of these cases. I will explain briefly why this chorus of lamentations is understandable, but considerably exaggerated. It is true that 4 of the cases involved environmental darlings with fundraising-friendly names, including the Natural Resources Defense Council, Earth Institute, Earth Island Institute, Riverkeeper Inc., and Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. How can you rule against those organizations? Well, they all lost. And the causes they were advancing included the protection of trees, whales, aquatic organisms, and what the court referred to as a small population of common fish, otherwise known in the parlance of my ancestors as bait. So how could you rule against all of them? Well, but the trees, the whales, and the aquatic organisms and the bait all lost. But the good news for the environmentalists is that in these four cases, the court was actually deferring in substantial part to the expertise and decisions, respectively, of the United States Navy on matters of national defense, the Forest Service, the Environmental Protection Agency, and the Army Corps of Engineers. What the environmentalist may have failed to have noticed, but I have, and you have, on January 20th of this year, the environmentalists captured each of these agencies, and they're in pretty good position to influence the positions these agencies take in the future. Hence, last term's bad news for trees and aquatic life, large and small, is really good news for the environmentalists, because the fundamental rationale for these decisions is empowerment for the inmates who are now going to be running the asylums. The bad news for the rest of us may well be that sometime in the future, the speculative impact on whales may outweigh the Navy's interest in effective, realistic training for its submarines. The most effective technology for power plant cooling procedures may require ignoring cost-benefit considerations. The Forest Service may be unable to remove timber from fire-damaged federal land, and gold mining in Alaska may be sacrificed to prolong the life of small, common, short-lived fish. The point here is that these things are what elections are all about. The environmental cases this term do not reflect judicial hostility to the environment. Far from it. They represent reasoned deference to administrative agencies the Congress has created to enforce our laws and protect our citizens. A word or two about the court's preemption jurisprudence. Preemption, as you know, is simply the operation of the Supremacy Clause. The laws of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, the laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding. That means our national government may regulate commerce in the interest of the nation as a whole and displace inconsistent or contrary state laws. Preemption has become a pendulum in the Supreme Court, swinging back and forth almost yearly. This year, the pendulum swung powerfully in favor of trial lawyers and tort case intervention in federally regulated commerce. Last year, it went the other way. I am unable to reconcile the court's seemingly irreconcilable positions. Someone, but not me, will have to do that. Let me recapitulate briefly. In February of 2008, in Regal versus Medtronic, an 8-1 court held that common law tort actions were preempted by the Federal Medical Devices Act that prohibited any state requirement relating to the safety or effectiveness if different from or in addition to any requirement imposed by the Federal Food and Drug Administration. That formulation preempted state common law duties. In other words, tort suits alleging that a product or label approved by the FDA was effective or misleading, those were preempted. Why allow random juries to redesign complex, life-saving medical devices that have already been approved after examination by the experts at the FDA? That February 2008 decision would seem to have foreclosed any argument that the Cigarette Labeling Act failed to preempt claims based upon Maine's deceptive advertising laws. The Labeling Act categorically preempts any requirement or prohibition based on smoking and health with respect to the advertising and promotion of cigarettes. But something happened between February of 2008 and December of 2008 when the court ruled 5-4 in Altray versus Good that claims for misleading advertising light cigarettes weren't preempted after all. Justice Stevens' opinion for the court relied on two premises. First, a presumption against preemption, and second, the conclusion that a state standard prohibiting deceptive advertising was not a requirement or prohibition based on smoking and health. It was just a prohibition based upon deception. So it wasn't preempted. As Justice Thomas pointed out in his dissent, The presumption against preemption had been thoroughly discredited in earlier decisions of the court in cases where there is conclusive evidence of congressional intent to preempt in the express words of the statute itself. In fact, the presumption had been rejected repeatedly and completely ignored in the February Regal decision, not even receiving a mention in the Stevens concurrence in this case. The Justice Thomas also pointed out that the holding that a generalized state standard was not something that could be preempted had also been rejected in the court's earlier decisions. There's some evidence the Altria versus Good case was argued on the first day of last term, as Doug pointed out. There's some evidence that there may have been a switch sometime after the decision, after the court voted, because Justice Stevens wrote the first and fifth opinion, and he would not normally be expected to do that. Justice Thomas didn't write, and who wrote the dissent in this case, didn't write an opinion until the 13th case argued in the term, which suggests that someone may have switched, and the Thomas dissent became a majority opinion, and the Stevens dissent, the Thomas dissent had been a majority opinion, and the Stevens majority opinion had been a dissent. That's just circumstantial evidence. And who flipped, if someone? Well, possibly Justice Kennedy, because he voted against preemption in the next case. I won't spend any time on Wyeth versus Levine, a pharmaceutical product preemption case that was argued in December. Again, a vote against preemption, this time joined by Justice Thomas, the second case was an implied preemption case, and Justice Thomas just doesn't agree with implied preemption on the basis of separation of powers grounds. In the final third preemption cases, the court held 5-4 that the comptroller of the currency did not preempt state efforts to regulate federal banking discrimination actions. This time, Justice Scalia joined the four liberals in upholding the lack of preemption. The dominant force in this preemption jurisprudence is Justice Stevens. He's been the author of opinions for the court or concurring or dissenting opinions in almost every preemption case in the last 20 years, sometimes losing, but coming back Rasputin-like to wind up on top this last year. He admits in this the Altria versus Good case that the jurisprudence in these cases lacks, he says, theoretical elegance. I've tried to figure out what it means to lack theoretical elegance, because that hasn't hampered anybody else on the Supreme Court. I think in this case it's a euphemism for incoherence. But it works. The very final action of the court on its last day before rising for the summer was to reschedule argument for September 9 in Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, asking the parties to readdress whether the court should overrule two of its campaign finance precedents that prohibit corporate funding of election advertising in the run-up to federal elections. Citizens United involved a 90-minute video documentary sharply critical of the history, character, and qualifications of presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. How could that be? 90 minutes? This was produced by our good friend David Bossy, who's right over there. Stand up, David. You're the only guy in the room. He appropriately named this his documentary, Hillary, the Movie. Because Citizens United, a nonprofit advocacy corporation, had received a tiny amount of its funding, roughly 1%, from corporations, the McCain-Feingold federal campaign laws made it a felony to broadcast the movie during the 2008 election cycle. A felony. Mr. Bossie's challenge to these rules and their enforcement brought him to the Supreme Court, arguing that the First Amendment, if it means anything at all, protects robust, uninhibited debate on the qualifications of persons running for president during the time when citizens are deciding how to vote. Because Mr. Bossie's case raised questions concerning the applicability of decisions fundamental to restrictions on political speech, the court has now scheduled the case for re-argument on September 9. The case is likely to be the first for Justice Sotomayor, if she is confirmed, and probably the first case to be argued by the new Solicitor General, Elena Kagan. During the oral argument this term in this case, the government conceded that the same theory that would allow the government to ban Mr. Bossie's movie from the airwaves could be used to prohibit publication of a book using corporate or union treasury funds. Even if a book contained one mention of a candidate's name in several hundred pages, the government asserted it could be banned. And the government acknowledged the same principle would apply to the use of a corporate, to use of corporate or union treasury funds for a sign held up in Lafayette Park saying vote for so-and-so. These expansive claims of governmental power to regulate and even suppress political speech seem to shock the justices, and I submit would shock anybody in this room. Mr. Bossie's nonprofit advocacy corporation threatens no corruption to the political process. Far from it, he is the modern-day equivalent of 18th-century pamphleteers whose advocacy inspired the First Amendment in the first place. The most important freedom we have, speech about our government and its leaders, is being restricted, indeed strangled, by a vast government regulatory bureaucracy created by federal campaign finance laws. The freedom to run for office or to talk about candidates for office is being smothered with requirements to hire armies of lawyers and accountants. Why is it easier to dance naked, burn a flag, or wear a shirt saying fuck the draft in a courthouse, these are all Supreme Court decisions, than it is to advocate the election or defeat of a president of the United States? That cannot be right, and we'll see. Well, I'm coming to the end. Speaking as I just did one of George Carlin's seven filthy words, you may wonder why I haven't discussed FCC versus Fox Television, the so-called fleeting expletive case, in which the court considered potential sanctions by the FCC against broadcasters for language referring to, this is the quote of the regulation, quote, referring to sexual or excretory activities or organs. The case involved in the words of the court has gotten more timid since it decided Cohen versus California, because it says isolated utterances of the F and S words during live broadcasts. And the lawyers actually debated among themselves whether they should say the full word or not during oral argument, which had been done, I understand, in the Second Circuit. They chickened out. No such words. They kept saying F word and S word and so forth. The argument, if you'd like to read it, is fun. But because they kept dancing around everything. But I haven't discussed the case because, notwithstanding how the argument was fun, the court turned what could have been a titillating case, so to speak, full of George Carlin's actual words, into a six-opinion splintered treatise on the arcane twists and turns of administrative law without addressing the constitutional questions or any really interesting sexual organs. This case turns out to be good reading only for administrative law aficionados. Now, I know that includes many of you in this room. But you're going to have to go to the actual opinions to get stirred up by this case. There is some fun stuff in the Scalia opinion, I'll give you that clue, about the headless fourth branch, and to use his words, letting Article III judges, like jackals stealing the lion's kill, expropriating power that Congress has wrested from the unitary executive. Is that Justice Scalia or what? I don't want to deprive you of the opportunity of digging this out and finding it yourself. Thus endeth today's lesson. Thank you for your patience.
We have a long tradition at the Federalist Society of giving our speaker a copy of the Federalist Papers. Usually, even when we know the speaker already has a copy or two of the Federalist Papers, we continue with that. But given the number of times Ted has spoken, we have chickened out and resorted to giving him a bottle of wine, our wine professional, otherwise executive vice president of the Federal Society, Leonard Leo, is in Europe, but he did indeed participate in the selection before it was done. So, Ted, I want to give you this. I want to thank you not only for a wonderful roundup of the court, but for all the wonderful things you've done for this organization over many, many years. Thanks, Ted.
If you already have a copy of the Federalist Papers, this is the next best thing. Thank you.